Really positive and very hot. Ajahn is moving up. Do you feel it? Do you feel the energy? Move up. Come on. Ajahn, don't you agree? The energy is fantastic here. Shall we ask them to move up to the stage? Yeah. Who wants to come to the stage? Ajahn, I think I need your help. Ajahn, they are not moving up.
Is that the at the bottom at the side? Yeah, just hold on to it.
No, you're good. No, down in the back is economy class. This is premium economy. Up here is business class. Up the front, next to the pilot. So those of you who want to really fly the best business class, there's only one first class seat, and that's this one. So I've got that one. So I'm sure that in a few minutes, a few people will be coming up here. When there's nowhere else they can sit. Never mind, we're going to be starting soon. And if one of the organizers, if they would kindly let me know what I'm supposed to be talking about tonight. I haven't seen any poster and I've had conflicting ideas. What am I supposed to be talking about tonight? Anything I want. No, I've talked about that before.
Today's topic is unlocking the secret of your mind.
Unlocking the secret of my mind or your mind? My mind is not a secret. I've been exposing my mind to you for many, many years. So anyway, we'll see how that goes. But in the meantime, we are still early. So we'll wait for a few more people to come in before we take off for today's talk. And it's soon getting crowded. Soon somebody will be coming up. Because the stage is free. You got so much space up here instead of being crowded. Yes! We have the first one on the stage. Thank you so much. When I was in Melbourne recently, last month, I gave a talk at Melbourne University. And the Buddhist group there, they hired, actually was given a big auditorium. But, this is very good. An ex-attendant from Singapore Airlines, and now he attends me. I only get people trained by Singapore Airlines first, and then once they've been well trained for many years, then I allow them to look after me. Good old Vincent. So anyway, while I was in Melbourne University, again, there was a big talk, so people filled up all the seats in the lecture theatre, and then they filled up the aisles, and then they filled up around the stage, all around me. And then the professor who was supposed to be introducing me, he came. He arrived on time, but he could not get into the lecture theatre. It was so full, which is wonderful. It had great atmosphere, which is one of the reasons why I like it when it gets nice and full. So, a few more people coming in, which is wonderful. And now I see some of the people I've just come from Thailand, from Hua Hin, where I was teaching a retreat for 7-8 days. And even though I was talking to people day and night during the retreat. Still they come back for more. You, some of you are so greedy for the Dhamma, always coming back for more. Which shows that there must be something very appealing and wonderful in listening to good teachings. You don't need to come, oh, that's the only way through, Pastor. So you can come in front, over here, over there, there's many places to sit. But please do not come and sit on my lap. That would ruin my reputation forever. It was just like during the retreat in Thailand. Because in Thailand, they have a rule that monks are not supposed to be touched by females. And I said, that's actually a cultural thing. It's not actually a rule in the Vinaya, in the monks' rules. So I said there was one doctor there, Dr. Willi, who was on the retreat. And I said, look, I know this is Thailand and you think you're not supposed to touch a monk, but please, Dr. Willi, the girl, please, if I have a heart attack, please give me CPR. Don't think, no, I'll have to let him die because a woman can't touch a monk. So please give me CPR, but please don't give me mouth to mouth. That wouldn't look good for a monk. Very good. Please sit down comfortably. Yes, more and more people are coming in. Whoa. Very good, lots of people are coming in. This year when I was in Indonesia giving a tour of cities teaching the Dhamma. In Medan, I'm very popular there, even though the hall holds 3,500 people. It always gets booked out very quickly. As soon as the opportunity to book for my talk was available online in Medan in Sumatra, it filled out in 35 minutes. And again, about the same time, the pop star Madonna was giving a concert in Jakarta. And she took at least 2 hours for her tickets to sell out. Mine was only 35 minutes. So you see who's more popular. I may not get paid as much as Madonna, but I certainly attract the crowds. Look at them all still coming in. And Madonna has security. I've got no security. But my security is my warm heart. So it means that you'll always look after me and care for me. Oh my goodness, there's more people coming in. What are we going to do? We're going to squeeze up. Because as Buddhists, we always like sharing everything. So if you can squeeze up and you can share all your diseases, all your contagions, all your bacteria. So we share. And for those of you who are start the talk, you've all heard in my first book called The Opening the Door of Your Heart. In that book, I taught people about the three rings of marriage. It's an old story because many people get married. And I ask people to consider the three rings of marriage. In that story, what is the first ring of marriage? Oh, come on. If you haven't read my book, you better buy it again. The first ring of marriage is the engagement ring. The second ring of marriage is? Wedding ring. And the third ring of marriage is?
Suffering.
Yeah, that's not nice. So we have now changed it to be more positive. So the first ring of marriage is now changed to offering. Offering. The second ring of marriage is called share ring. And the third ring of marriage is care ring. That's much nicer, the three rings of marriage. Offering, share ring, and care ring. The three rings of a marriage. Okay, there's even more people trying to get in. Some people outside seeing all these people coming up here, wondering where they're fitting in. They probably think that this must be Doctor Who and his TARDIS. How many people can you fit into this hall? On the outside it looks small, and on the inside it's huge. Excellent. I don't know why so many people are coming tonight. It must mean that there's nothing on the TV tonight. So they come and watch me instead. Maybe next time we can do this, we could broadcast it live on TV. What's your favorite channel on Singapore? No TV. Channel News Asia. Okay, so this can next time be broadcast live on Channel News Asia. So you can sit at home and watch it at home. Would that be cool? No, it's nothing like being live, being there when it happens. Okay, so the time now is just gone past 7:30. So is anyone going to introduce me? If not, I can introduce myself. Is there an MC? Okay. I will now introduce the MC for this evening.
So, thank you very much, Ajahn Brahm. In kind return, I will introduce Ajahn Brahm again. So, ladies and gentlemen, without further introduction, let us put our palms together and just say sadhu three times to welcome Ajahn Brahm. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Very good. So today's talk is about unlocking the secrets of your heart or your mind. Which one should it be, your mind or your heart? We do that afterwards. Because on this talk there is no entrance fee. We never charge people entrance fee for talks, but you will find if you want to leave early that you have to pay exit fee. No, I'm only joking. There's no entrance fees or exit fees at all. So, unlocking the secrets of your mind or your heart. First of all, the story about what is your mind. Because many people, scientists, philosophers, they have been thinking for years, what is the mind? And there are some people who say they've lost their mind, and they don't know exactly what they've lost. You ask them, where did you lose your mind? Did you lose your mind in the bathroom or the MRT on the way to work? If so, you can go to Lost Property and see if there's any minds which have been handed in. But no, we say the lost your mind is to lost your senses. And sometimes people say they've got broken heart. But if you have broken heart and you go and see the doctor, it's still in one piece. It's not been shattered, because we say the heart and mind We all know intuitively what it is, which is why we use those words. The center of our being. What runs our life. Who we think we are. What drives us. The mind or the heart. But first of all, one of the greatest stories which I managed to collect of what is the mind. And so many scientists and philosophers have tried to understand this. And the explanation which I give you now, even though I've said it before and many of you keep coming back, look, even the Rolling Stones keep on playing their old songs again. At their age, they don't invent new songs. The same with Madonna, she does old songs. So of course, I will also do some old stories again. But, even though some of these stories you think you've heard them before, every time they're told, you can see deeper into them. Other angles, other perspectives. So never think, oh, I know this story. Because if you really did know stories, if you really did understand them, you will be a monk or a nun by now. And obviously you're not. So this was the story of an old friend from the time I was at college in Cambridge. Still keep in touch with him. And he wrote to me about his daughter when she went to grade one at school. The teacher in one of the lessons asked the class, what is the biggest thing in the world? And one of the five-year-olds immediately put their hand up. My daddy. My daddy is the biggest thing in the world. For someone who's only 5 years of age, your daddy is very big. Actually, today, somebody said, because I went to the Little Gems kindergarten this morning, and they said, no, not my daddy, my Kong Kong. He is so fat. And the little girl said she bounced on his tummy when he was laying down. He said, we haven't got a trampoline. That's the best thing which I can use, my Kong Kong's tummy. I thought that was really funny and cute. But, and also when the Kong Kong, he's so fat, whenever he falls down, he just bounces back up again. But five-year-olds are really cute. But this little boy said, my daddy is the biggest thing in the world. And another boy put his hands up, said, no, 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 a elephant is much, much bigger than your daddy. And another child put their hand up, no, 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 mountain, a mountain is much bigger than an elephant. And then the daughter of my friend put her hand up and said, my eye is the biggest thing in the world. And no one knew what she meant, not even the teacher. So they asked her, I'm just explaining, your eye's only tiny. What do you mean your eye is the biggest thing in the world? Well, said this five-year-old, my eye can see her daddy. My eye can see an elephant and a mountain and so much more. If all of that can fit into my eye must be the biggest thing in the world. And I thought how smart that child was at five, seeing things in a different way than no one else could see. The eye was the biggest thing in the world for her. And eventually, she went to Oxford to do postgrad work in biophysics, I think. Brilliant even at five. But I wrote back to my friend and I said, I give that 9 out of 10. Not 10 out of 10, because your mind can see everything your eye will ever see, and so much more things which you will imagine, which you will never see with your real eyes. Your mind can hear real and imaginary sounds. It can also smell, taste, it can feel sensations, and it also has its own area which only the mind can perceive. In fact, everything you can ever know and experience can fit into your mind. So isn't it the case, your mind is the biggest thing? Because everything you will ever experience can fit into it. So it is the biggest thing. And you may have noticed, I never said biggest thing in the world, because the world can fit into your mind. So your mind is the biggest thing. Everything can fit into it. And I've told that to universities, to scientists, to philosophers, and no one has ever been able to find an argument to refute that. Your mind is huge, the biggest thing ever. Everything can fit into it. Now you know what the mind is. And now you will also understand why people can't locate the mind anywhere. Many years ago, people thought their mind lived in the heart, until somebody gave another person a heart transplant. They took somebody's heart and put it in another person's body. And I remember watching the news on TV and wondering, who would they wake up as? The owner of the heart or the owner of the body? And you know what happened? They woke up as the owner of the body, not the owner of the heart. But interestingly, I read many books about heart transplants. And it's not as simple as just waking up out of anesthetic as the owner of the body, not of the heart, because still some memories of the owner of the heart remain. There was one of these amazing stories. A young girl, 8 or 9 years of age, needed a heart transplant and was given one. And after she recovered, the operation was successful. After she recovered enough to go home, she started having nightmares. And the nightmares were always the same, of walking in an alleyway late at night and being attacked and killed. And because the nightmares were the same and were recurrent, the mother asked the doctor, what is happening? And the doctor said, oh, it is only the trauma of a major operation. Soon your daughter will forget about it. But it kept on happening. And the mother started getting suspicious. Always the same dream of being killed. So the mother went to the local police station and told the police about her daughter's dream. And the police were very, very interested, because the location described in the dream of this murder and all the other details matched perfectly one of their unsolved crimes. So the police checked with the hospital, and sure enough, the owner, the previous owner of the heart, was a young lady who got attacked and killed in that place. And thank you to all the memories which this little girl had in her dream. They had a suspect, they interviewed him, and he confessed. He confessed to being the murderer of the previous owner of this girl's heart. Fascinating. There was some memory left in the heart of this young woman, this young girl, enough to catch the killer of the previous owner of the heart. But then, after a few more weeks, all those memories faded. Somehow, your memories continue on. So, but that is not just the location of the mind being in the heart. But what would happen, you think, if someone gave you a brain transplant? Suppose I had some illness and I died, and they decided to give the president of the Buddhist Fellowship, Winston, my brain. He's over there, he's our president. And when Winston came out of anesthetic, there he is, would he be Winston or would he be Ajahn Brahm? Would he be able to tell jokes in the committee meetings? Would he have all these stories and be a good meditator? He had my brain. What do you think? Once you realize the mind is not in the brain, the mind is not in the heart, the brain and the heart are in the mind, then you can answer those things. So, that is the nature of the mind. It's one of the reasons we can't see it and measure it, because it's too big. But once we know what it is, it can be very easy to understand how we can unlock those secrets to our benefit and our advantage. Because once we know what the mind is and how, being so big, it can change even our body, we can use these things to help our health, first of all. There is so much sickness in our modern world, and it takes so much money from the government income, all your taxes. But when you understand the secret of the mind, you can make people much healthier just by using the power of your mind. Easy to do. Because I often go doing chanting to people who are sick. Have you ever asked the monks to go to your grandfather's bedside to chant for him when they're sick? I have to do this a lot. And some people think, oh, that's just superstition. It doesn't work. But it does. Recently, one of my favorite stories I've been telling recently, I went to the ICU of a hospital in Perth. The family had an old man, their grandfather, their father, who was really sick and dying. He was in the ICU, intensive care unit. I don't know why they call it ICU, because not many people are allowed in. So it used to be called I Can't See You. But anyway, they call it ICU. It should be I Can't See You. But I went in there on the invitation of the family. He was dying, and I chanted, and I chanted, and I chanted, really superpower chanting. I've got a strong mind. I can unlock its secrets. I can give it really zap. So I zapped it. And it worked. It was like a miracle. He got better. He was on the edge of death and he turned around. He recovered. A miracle. And once he recovered, that's when I got into big trouble. Because the family were very angry at me. Because they told me, Ajahn Brahm, half of these people here have come from overseas. We invited them to come quickly because the fellow was dying. Now they all have to go home again and come back later. We'd arranged the funeral. It was all organized. Now we have to cancel everything because of you. We wanted you just to go and chant so he can die peacefully. Not that he can get better. Now you've messed it all up. So from that time on, when anybody asked me, can you go to hospital to do some chanting? I say, what type of chanting? Get better chanting or die peacefully chanting. Because if I do the wrong one, I'm getting into big trouble every time. The two. So I always have to know the right type of, but it actually works, I've seen this. The power of the mind is immense. I just told people this afternoon when I went to somebody's house to do some chanting. I did ask them, I think they're here this evening, an Indonesian family living in Singapore a long time now. I asked them, they wanted me to do some blessing chanting. And so I had to ask them, what type of chanting do you want? To die? So we're all healthy, we don't want that chanting. To get a good blessing chanting. Now, once I did some chanting for an Australian girl, Caucasian. She heard that I do chanting and she wanted her house blessed. So I did it for her on the way into my center on a Friday night. And she called me that evening. She said, amazing thing happened. Yes. The power of the mind. So, what happened was that her daughter came home from school, 13 or 14 years of age, never interested in what her mother was interested in, Buddhism, just interested in boys and computers and texting people, all that sort of stuff. So, when the 13-year-old came into the house, straight away, she said, Mummy, something is different in the house. What's happening? I never told my daughter, said the mother, that you've been in there. But as soon as she came in the house, she could feel it. And she's never such a sensitive person before. Obviously, there's something happening with the power of the mind translated into chanting. But there's even more amazing stories of the power of the mind. Because as a monk, we develop that power. We do unlock its secrets, its energies and its powers. And there are some amazing stories, unbelievable but true. I go traveling a lot. When I go through the airport in Singapore, you always have to go through the security screen. When you walk through the gate, beep, 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 beep. Sometimes it's my shoes, they've got metal buckles on. Sometimes you may have some a phone or some keys in your pocket. And those sensor gates are so sensitive they can pick up even small things. But once, Once one of my friends who has a monastery in San Francisco, he was meeting a Thai monk who was coming to give some talks. And as soon as a Thai monk came out from the immigrations and the customs, this Thai monk saw my friend who was fiddling around with a zip on his monk's bag. And so the monk who'd just come out from the airport said, "What's wrong with your zip?" Said, "It's stuck." And the monk said, "I can fix that." And he opened up his robe, and inside he had so many pockets with screwdrivers, knives, little pliers. He had a whole tool case which he carries around with him into the cabin of aircraft. And even knives as well. And the monk who was receiving said, "You didn't take that into the cabin of the aircraft, did you?" He said, "Yeah, of course. I do it every time." "But when you go through the security, how come you don't get caught?" And they're going to go beep, 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 beep. "How come?" He said, "My chanting and my meditation. When I go through, there's so much metal inside of me and on me. I just do my chanting and my meditation. And the machine never beeps." So much for anti-terrorism. We monks know how to get metal inside the aircraft. Fortunately, only good monks can do those tricks, not terrorists. So you're perfectly safe. But it's true, we saw that. How on earth can that happen, do you think? Going through those metal detectors with a whole tool case on your chest and never ever getting caught. That is true, not exaggeration. But one of the nicest stories of the power of the mind and how to unlock its secrets, that was a monk who'd been meditating a long time. This was a layman who came to stay at my monastery just for 1 year. But 1 year, you learn many tricks. And in that year, he learned how to meditate. And then he went back to Germany to continue his studies. And when he went to university, the first day on the campus of this university in Germany, he was passing an ATM. And as he passed the ATM made a noise. And he thought that noise was the machine's way of saying, "Welcome to my university." That's what he thought. A machine was welcoming him. So from that day on, he'd only ever use that ATM. No other ATMs at all. And whenever he used the ATM, he was always very kind to the ATM. Never pushing the buttons too hard. Never banging the ATM when it took too much time to get your money out. Never swearing at the ATM when he found he did not have enough money in the bank to get any funds out. He was always very kind to the ATM, and after he made his transaction and the money came out, he'd always say thank you, danke in German, to the ATM. He was always really kind to the ATM. And after several months, he got his karmic reward. Do you think the machine can know a person's kindness? Do you think a mind can affect a machine? He was sitting having his lunch just within a few feet of the ATM. No one had gone close to that ATM for about 20 minutes. He would have seen them. He was having his lunch there. And then he heard the same sound which he first heard on his first day at that university. The same welcoming sound. And he turned around and he saw coming out from that ATM a 20 euro note. No one had pressed any buttons. No one had been close to there for 15 minutes. So he went up to the ATM, he picked out the 20 euro note, he waved it. Does this belong to anybody? No one claimed it. And he realized it belonged to him. The ATM was saying thank you. So if you are short of cash, please go to the Buddhist Fellowship. Learn some meditation, and when you go past the ATM, get your mind into the ATM. Nice ATM, kind ATM, now cough up 50 Sing dollars. Who knows? It can work. And for those of you who want to see how it works, unlocking the secrets of the mind, when you go back home, you can get on the internet and type in the four letters P-E-A-R. Pear. It was a Princeton-led project. Princeton University, one of the top Ivy League colleges. The college where Albert Einstein went to in the United States. They have recently done some research, and it's called the Pear Project, P-E-A-R, like the fruit, about how the mind can influence random events and make the results statistically proven to be influenced by people's minds. A very successful project. P-E-A-R, done by Princeton, proving how the mind can influence physical things. It can do that. P-E-A-R project. Of course, the people they were using were just ordinary students, not just like monks who can do stuff. Da, 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 da. It's only very good that I can't touch money, otherwise all the ATMs in Singapore will run out of cash very quickly whenever I need something. But it is true that sometimes you see these things. How do they happen? Once you realize they do happen, your mind does have power. And once you accept that and believe that, and the evidence is there, then you can make use of it. I said with your health. Now how many people suffer from the disease of cancer? And how many people think you can't do anything about it? Just the radiation, the chemotherapy, you just have to accept what the doctors do. Without many doctors these days say, no, you take you participate in your treatment. Change your diet. Change your habits. And I say change your mind. Use your mind. Because it does have power, especially with diseases like cancer. Just to believe you can heal yourself, just that very belief will open up new doors to exercise the power of your mind on your own body. But this was a classic experiment done in hypnotism, in hypnosis. It demonstrates how powerful the mind can be to affect your body when it should not be able to. They had a man under hypnosis, and they had a nail on the end of a stick, just like a 4-inch nail, which you can see in a hardware store. And under hypnosis, they told this man that nail was at a high temperature. It was red hot. The truth was that nail was ordinary temperature. You could pick it up, put it down, and nothing would happen. It was just ordinary room temperature. But they hypnotized this guy to think it was boiling hot, red hot. And then they touched the man's arm with that nail. Because he believed it was red hot, he screamed in pain. That was understandable. But what the researchers never expected, a blister came up from his skin. The skin was actually damaged, even though it was a nail at room temperature. It wasn't just the fact he believed. His belief on his mind had actually changed something in his skin, and he was burnt as a result of that. Your mind has enormous power to interfere with your body. It can even kill you. If you believe you're going to die, you do die. This was another experiment which I read about when I was still a student. It was a very cruel experiment which has never been done since because it was immoral. But nevertheless, this happened in the year, I think, 1899, over 100 years ago, in the prison, the jail, in the city of Bristol, in the UK. In those days, there was many, many crimes. You had to suffer capital punishment. People were hung. And this poor man had done some crime, and he had to be hung according to law. And so a couple of scientists got permission to do an experiment on him the night before. He was going to be hung the next day. They came to his cell, this poor man about to be executed the next day. And they said, they lied. They said the law has been changed. Tomorrow you will die, but not by hanging. You will have your throat cut. And they left this poor man to think about that all night, his last day on earth, believing the following morning he'd have his throat cut and be executed that way instead of hanging. And in the morning, they came for him at dawn. They gave him his last rites. And then they tied his hand behind his back and put a blindfold over his face and led this poor man to the place of execution. He had a blindfold on so he couldn't see where he was going or what they were doing, because where they led him to was the washroom in the prison. And there, one of the scientists took what we used to call the old-fashioned razors. One edge was very sharp, the other one was blunt. And the scientist drew the blunt edge of the blade across this man's throat. It never even scratched him. At the same time, one of the other scientists turned on one of the taps in the basin, in the washroom. And this man, he thought he was going to be executed by having his throat cut. He felt the cold, hard steel go across his throat. He couldn't see anything, he just felt it. And then he heard liquid coming out. He thought he'd had his throat cut, even though he hadn't. He fell to the ground and died right there. Even though there was no reason for him to die, only he believed he was going to die. That was a classic experiment done in psychology. Never again, because it's just too immoral to do something like that. But still, it showed how there was no physical cause for him dying. It wasn't a heart attack, he just died. And only because he believed he was going to die. Now, translate that to our modern time. ordinary people in hospitals. The doctor comes up to you and says there's no hope. Or Ajahn Brahm comes to visit you. Now, I'm very careful who I go to visit in hospital, because you all know I'm very, very, very busy. So I'll only go and visit you in hospital if it's really serious. So if you're only in hospital for a small thing, I won't come and visit you. Because if I do, you say, Ajahn Brahm, what are you visiting me for? Is this something my doctor hasn't told me? Ah, I must be dying soon. So, only if you're very serious will I come and see you. So if I do see you in hospital, you know you're in trouble. Busy, you can't just waste time with everybody. You're going to get better anyway. So, so that many of you, if you're told by the doctor there's hardly any chance for you, and you believe that, just your belief might be what kills you. Just like a person believed he was going to die because he had his throat cut, he did die. Which is why I never say to people, even though I've seen the doctor's report, that you are going to die. Because if I do say that, and they believe me, they are dead. I always say that there's always a chance. You never know. Give it a try. And just that much, when people don't believe they're going to die, many people who would otherwise be dead are alive. Fascinating, especially with cancer. One of my favorite monks, I was talking about him in Bangkok a few nights ago. Because he was a monk called Ajahn Tate, a great monk. Sometimes people say, are there enlightened monks alive these days? You know, I won't say if there are enlightened monks alive today, but certainly, now there are, but this was one I knew when I was a young monk, absolutely certain. This monk was fully enlightened. And this was his story. When I first became a monk in Thailand 42 years ago, this monk had a very bad cancer. He was well respected, and so His Majesty the King of Thailand paid for all his medical expenses in one of the best hospitals in Bangkok. But even with the top doctors, it was not working. So, they told him, nothing more we can do, you're going to die soon. And this monk replied, well, if I'm going to die, I'm not going to die in a hospital. I'm going back to my monastery, which was on the banks of the Mekong River. I will go there to die. I think it was about 25 or 30 years later, he eventually died. As soon as he got out of hospital, he started getting better again. Because he didn't believe the doctors all the time. And also, I do recall, I was giving some talks in Malaysia, in Ipoh, because Judy from Ipoh is here somewhere, I saw her earlier. I was giving some talks in Ipoh, and was going from Ipoh to Penang, being driven. And in the car, one of the disciples, she was a doctor, an oncologist, about to retire. She said, I've been in this field all my life, treating people with various types of cancer. And she said, I've noticed something all this time, that when my patients come into the consulting room, I don't need to look at their biopsies or the pathology reports. I can tell, she said, and I think she said 95% accuracy, who is going to survive and who is going to die. And she told me it's got nothing to do with how advanced the cancer is. Stage 1, 2, 3, 4, that is not what tells me they're going to live or they're going to die. She said, I can tell just by their attitude, by their state of mind. And that really hit me, because this was a doctor who'd been in that field for so many years. and was just saying her anecdotal experience. She could tell who would survive and who wouldn't just by the attitude of mind. The attitude of mind of being peaceful, hopeful, positive, said that would keep them alive. But if you believed you were going to die, that was it. You were dead. And that's a powerful, that just shows that there's something really important to unlock the secrets of the mind. Positive thinking, having a good, kind, wonderful way of looking at life, that does really work. Your mind does influence your body. If you are negative, you're dead. If you are happy, you're alive. I am a happy monk, and I try and make other people happy because I know that's good for your health. But sometimes some of you are so concerned about my health, and you give me all sorts of medicines. I don't need medicines to keep me healthy, although I do take vitamin C regularly. I take vitamin C, vitamin coffee. I also take vitamin T as well, a cup of tea. Those are the two vitamins which keep me healthy, C and T, coffee and tea. But no, it's not just that. Because I saw this piece of research, and it's important about the attitude and unlocking the secrets of your mind. And the research showed that when you are happy, when you laugh, the blood vessels in your body expand. They get wider. But when you're miserable, when you're angry, when you're afraid, the blood vessels close up. They get tighter and smaller. Which means that the more you laugh, the more happy you are, the less you worry about things in life, the more your blood vessels expand and get bigger and bigger and bigger. I've been laughing for so many years now. My blood vessels, they're like super highways. Like these 12-lane freeways in California. They are huge. And that means I can eat anything I like. Because it can't get clogged up. There's too much width in my blood vessels. That is why I'm healthy as well as being fat. So if you are overweight, you better start laughing quickly. Otherwise, you're dead. The state of mind does influence your body. Just happiness. Good mind. And I've seen this, again, too many times. There's this one fellow. One out of many. This is just one example. I'm going to give two examples. Second example, another guy from Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia comes and visits me every year because about 7 or 8 years ago, he came to see me with stage 4 lung cancer. Basically about to die. Stage 4. And I gave him some good advice, some positive advice. And he now comes back every year, say thank you Ajahn Brahm for another year of life. And always gives a donation out of gratitude. It worked. I changed his mind. His cancer went. But the most impressive case was this man called George from the east of London. There's very few people talk with a real Cockney accent. But this guy does. So much so that even though I live in Australia where people talk English, I am the only one who can understand what he's saying. Good old George. But he told me his story. He went to the He had a cancer, lung cancer, because he smoked. In those days, people didn't realize that smoking was going to cause you cancer. By the time the evidence was out there, he had the cancer. And he went to see the doctor one day, his oncologist. They gave him an x-ray, which they used to do in those days for lung cancers. And the oncologist showed him a copy of the results. The lung cancer was in every part of both lungs. He said, it's all over. Your lungs are riddled with the cancer. And he said, sometimes we may think of doing, of cutting out some of the infected, or not the infected, the cancer in your lungs. But if we did surgery, we'd have to take everything out, all both lungs. And obviously we can't do that. So he said, we can give you radiation therapy and chemotherapy, but it's so far advanced, you can only extend your life by maybe 2 months or 3 months, that's all. What do you want to do? And so George, shocked obviously, he went back home and said, I'll talk it over with my wife and come back to you in a few days, in a week. So he talked it over with his wife. And like many people, why go through very unpleasant radiation and chemotherapy just for an extra 1 or 2 months? He said, no, no. When he went back to see his doctor, he said, I'll just let nature take its course. No need for any radiation or chemotherapy. And the doctor says, while you're here, we'll give you another x-ray to find out how the disease has progressed over the last 7 days. You give me some understanding of how long you've got. So he had another x-ray. It was developed pretty quickly. And he went into the oncologist's room for the second time. And he saw his doctor looking at the new x-ray, shaking his head. And poor old George told me he got so scared. But he said, be honest with me, doctor. It's got really worse, hasn't it? How many more days have I got? And at which the doctor looked up and said, George, I'm shaking my head because I've never seen this before in my life. The cancer has gone. Totally disappeared. I can't believe the results. There's no cancer left. Only in 1 week. What have you been doing, George? And George said, meditating. He learned meditation from me. And so the doctor said, carry on. And you know, as far as I know, that was years ago, about 10, 15 years ago that happened. And he's still alive. Haven't seen him for the last year. He may have died of something else, but you know, certainly his cancer went. Now, it's amazing. That's a true story. How on earth can that happen? Simply understanding your mind has have an effect on your body. You can do stuff. If a mind can get a 20-euro note out of an ATM machine, surely he can get sort of the cancers also to diminish and go. So it doesn't happen with everybody. Some people, the karma is, you know, your time is up. Time to get a new body, go to a new life. But sometimes, give people a chance. Never give up hope. If you do give up hope, negative mind, and this is what kills you. Or, a lady did some marvelous research on, and I saw her talk on the TED channel. You know, the TED channel, which shows innovative research. And people go in there for 5 minutes, and some of what they say is just, again, how the mind can intervene with the body. And in this particular case, a researcher, she was a researcher in medicine, she was always concerned and intrigued why people in our modern world who have very demanding jobs, CEOs, managers, vice presidents, why people with very stressful jobs Some of them get cardiac disease and others are healthy. What is the difference? Why does the stress of your job affect some people and not others? And this is very important for you in Singapore to know this, because many of you have very stressful jobs and many of you will develop cardiac disease. And she found out the difference. She said it was the attitude of your mind. People in the same amount of responsibilities and duties, the same amount of stress, who regarded what they did as a challenge. They regarded it as positive. Some are going to learn from, some are going to make them stronger. Some, I'm going to do this. I'm going to make it happen. I'm going to have a positive attitude to all this work which I'm doing. Like me, I live a very stressful job, being a Buddhist monk. It's true. I work really hard all day. And even last night I never slept very much. The aircon wasn't working all that well in my room. But still I've been working all day. This morning with little children. That's really tiring. I don't know how you parents manage that. 5-year-old. But it was good fun. I really enjoyed their company. And they were just really... But you get very tired afterwards. And then, after that, with the lunch diner, which I went today, talking to people there and rushing back to see the teens afterwards, and then coming out here, a really long day. And I just come back from a trip over to Thailand while I was working hard. Sometimes I do 16-hour days. And people, nothing. This happened once actually here in the Harbour City, that when I was giving a talk there, at question time, I always remember this, this young man came to the microphone and said, Ajahn Brahm, all that you say is very inspiring, but what does a monk know about life in Singapore? You live in your monastery, you have an easy life. We have to work really hard in Singapore. And that really got me going. And I said, you don't understand the life of a monk like Ajahn Brahm. And I said, I detailed everything I'd done that day. I get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. It's just my habit. I can't not do that anymore. Even when I go to bed late and want to sleep in, I just wake up at 4 o'clock. It's just my training. So I said, I started at 4 o'clock in the morning. What time did you start? I said, 7. I said, you lazy bum, you don't know how to work. I never said that. And then I worked really hard. I said, everything I'd done that day, no break. Even when I have my lunch is work. People watch me. And they say, Ajahn Brahm, please take something of this. I made it specially for you. And I had to chant afterwards and then talk to people afterwards. And they ask questions about their marriage, their kids, their health, all the things I don't know anything about. So this is not, there's no such thing as a free lunch for a monk. I work for it. And I have to chant as well. Chant and answer questions. And that's my lunch hour. You know, you've been there and seen me, that's true. So I worked all day. It was about 10:30, 11 o'clock at night when this last question came. And I said everything I'd done since 4 a.m. in the morning. I said, look, don't ever say that I don't know about working hard and stress. I know what I'm talking about. And then this guy came back to the microphone. I always remember what he said next. He said, I never realized how hard a monk has to work. He said, I always planned one day to ordain as a monk, but not now, no way. I lost a candidate. But, so I do work hard, but my health is great. Why? Because whatever I do, I never get negative. Oh, why do I have to teach kids? Why do I have to sign another book? You know, some of those books over there, we printed them with a signature already in them. There's already a signature in them. Does it work? No. We want another signature, a real one. So I'd sign two signatures on books. And do I complain? Yes, sometimes. But when I do, I think, stupid Ajahn Brahm, don't complain. Because I know when I get negative and complaining, my arteries close. And I'm going to likely to have bad cardiac health. It's going to really hurt you. I'm not going to go that path. And this is what that woman found on that TED Talk. Doing medicals on many CEOs in the United States and seeing the ones who have the really positive attitude to their work. They're not going to complain. They're just going to do it. They're going to have their photograph taken. They're going to make it fun. If they're going to be interrupted in their work, they're not going to complain. They're going to enjoy it. Those are the people who have great cardiac health. You have a positive mind which doesn't complain. That's the secret of the mind. Keep it positive. Don't complain. Don't get negative. Don't blame other people. Don't blame yourself. Why do you want to get into the blame game? Why do you always want to blame your boss for being such a nasty person to work for? You asked for that promotion. You worked for that promotion. Now you've got it. Stop complaining. People complain about marriage, their wife, their husband. No one forced you to marry them. You chose them. So stop complaining. What did you expect? Don't you talk to other people who are married? You should talk to other people who are married first. What was that joke about the man? He brought a friend back home after work without telling his wife. He just surprised his wife. I'm bringing a friend home for dinner. And his wife said, what did you do that for? Look, my hair's a mess. I haven't put on some nice clothes. The house is a mess. What did you do that for? It's a rotten thing to do. You shouldn't surprise me. You should have called me first of all if you're inviting somebody home. Then I could, you know, make the house look presentable and I could dress up. I can get something nice for them to eat. Why did you do this, you bad husband? And he said, my friend here was thinking about getting married. I thought I'd tell him what it was like first of all. That was a joke I read in the book. So you know what's happening. It's a hard work. But with a positive attitude to a marriage, just like with a positive attitude to your body, you can make it work. But if you complain about your partner, you complain about yourself, you're killing a marriage just like you kill yourself. The power of the mind to keep a healthy body, good cardiac health, and a good marriage. It doesn't depend on who your wife is, who your husband is. It really depends upon knowing the positive mind can change everything, can give you a lot of happiness and relationship health as well. So once we know the secret of the mind, it's not the world creates the problems, it's the way we look at the world. You can't change your husband, but you can change the way you look at him. You can't change a wife. Many husbands have tried, and they fail miserably. But you can change your attitude towards her. You cannot change your parents. You're stuck with them for life. But you can always change your attitude towards them. And how you do this, a quick trick before I stop. If you look at another person, say your mother-in-law. I don't know why mothers-in-law always seem to be more of a problem than fathers-in-law. But I think one of the reasons is, if you go home and you can prove that this is right, write out the letters of mother-in-law, rearrange the letters and you find it spells Hitler woman. Mother-in-law is an anagram of Hitler woman. But it doesn't need to be that way. So look at your mother-in-law. If you want to change the relationship using the power of the mind, look at her with a positive mind. Look for her beautiful, good qualities. They're there. And once you start seeing her good qualities, her kind qualities, once you, the daughter-in-law, sees that, then she will show them back to you. Whatever you see and expect in another person is what they show you back. So if you expect your parents to be controlling, then that's what you get. If you expect your parents to be kind, if that's what you see in them, their kindness, their love, their beauty, then that's what they show you back. That's the power of the mind. Once you understand that, it's so easy to have a good relationship with almost anybody. This is what I learned by going into prisons. I saw the good, the beauty, the kindness, the softness in serial killers. Once I saw that, that's what they showed me back. If I saw that guy is a monster, then that's what they would show me back. If you think your wife is a monster, that's what you'll see. If you see her as this beautiful, kind woman, that's what she will show you. That is the secret of the mind. So, I've been talking again for far too long, over an hour. So I believe what we do next is Q&A. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay, very good. So MC, go and get some questions.
Okay, so brothers and sisters, now is the time for question and answer.
He said that really well. You should be on the TV for the interviewing the politicians and everybody else. That was really cool.
Okay, so there is this one special question coming from Indonesia. So some sister was helping to post it. This is the first question, Ajahn Brahm. Dear Bhante, thank you very much for your Dhamma sharing, which has always been my guidance. Currently, I am facing a downturn in my life. I found out that my husband is cheating me outside. He has been doing this when our first child was 3 months old. He has been lying all the times and our relationship is getting worse. I'm really saddened and heartbroken and I don't know how to move forward. I try to meditate but all those bad memories always appear and hurt myself. I have sleepless nights. Bhante, would you please advise me? What should I do?
Okay, first of all, please, you should have followed my advice before you got married. Never marry a rich man. Because only a rich man can afford mistresses. Marry a poor man. Then they can't afford. No mistress wants to go with a poor man. Oops. Marry a poor man. If he happens to be rich, now after you get married, because he works hard and successful, make sure you spend all his money first. So he's got no money to get a mistress. Isn't that a good idea, ladies? Yeah! Because otherwise, guys, let your wife spend the money. Otherwise, too much temptation. But anyway, also, whose fault was that? No, whoever wrote that question, you didn't commit adultery. You didn't go with somebody else. Your husband did. So why allow his bad karma to make you unhappy? The reason is because it is especially true, please excuse me, of women, you always take the blame for your husband's bad conduct. You think it's your fault. It's not. It's his fault. He's the one going out with the mistress, not you. You didn't send him out and say, husband, go and get a mistress. He did it. So why do you get upset when you never did anything wrong, when somebody else did something wrong? It's because you take the blame, and you should never do that. So, it's not your fault, whoever wrote that. You're probably a really good, kind woman. Maybe just, you know, after the pregnancy, you know, that, you know, he couldn't sort of have warm relationships with him, you know what I mean, for a while. So that's why he just, you know, went to somebody else. So that's not a good excuse. Just wait a while. So whatever, it was his fault. So now, don't blame yourself. So the thing to do, now don't have sleepless nights. You did nothing wrong. And it's sometimes there's many other women in the same situation. Now what to do with that? You have children, he's their father, going through a separation and divorce. It's really cost a lot of emotional capital. It's a very difficult thing to do, separating and going through a divorce. So much so, you know here, divorce has got such a bad name. Even saying the word divorce is just so embarrassing. That's why, of course, you know, I've said this many times, we don't call it divorce anymore in Buddhism. What do we call it?
Recycling,
yes. So don't say you're getting divorced, say we're getting recycled. Which is so true, you know. The ex-wife goes and gets another partner, the husband gets another wife. So that's our modern life, we get recycled. So, but also, don't blame anybody. Sometimes this happens, and it's his fault, obviously. You did nothing wrong. But sometimes that happens. Do you really want to try and repair that marriage? Because it can be done. But sometimes both people need to want to repair it. If he wants to, you know, have the mother of his children as his wife again, if that's what he wants, it can be done. If that's what you want, you know, you can forgive him. And I have seen, personally counseled many couples where the husband has committed adultery. He has had a mistress. And the wife forgives him. And they work it out. And they come back together again. And their marriages, they are rock solid once they've been through that pain. If they really can come together again, the guy usually looks at his wife and says, wow, she's forgiven me for something which was such a... I never expected her to have such forgiveness and such love for me. She could actually forgive me. He never... Usually, most cases, they never take advantage of your forgiveness. It really gets to their heart, the heart of a man. This is one amazing woman. I don't deserve to have her love after what I've done to her. But she continues to give it to me. This is amazing. He realizes the value of that wife and will never have an affair outside of marriage again. I've seen that many times. The nature of most men is to be so thankful that their wife will come back to them. But he has also to have to break off, you know, the relationship. Usually it's such a simple thing to do. Change your email. Stop the phone. Change the phone numbers. So that mistress doesn't have your email, doesn't have your phone numbers, can't contact you, and after a while you lose all interest. And she loses interest in you as well. It's only a temporary disease. It's eminently curable if you want to cure it. So this is one way you can do that. But if
you come to the decision it's already gone too far, the relationship is over, then please don't blame yourself. So you no need to have sleepless nights. Not your fault. You never did anyone karma. Let it go. Go through the recycling process. And next time, choose your partner a bit more carefully. Usually, when boys and girls choose one another, they just look at the chassis of the car. She's hot. He's cute. Now, how many of you would choose a car to drive in Singapore just because the chassis looks shiny? You'd check the engine. You'd go to all these magazines to check the performance, the reliability, you know, the fuel consumption. Why on earth don't you do that when you choose a partner? Choose the reliability of the engine, the fuel consumption, how much that girl's going to cost you, whether she's cheap to run or expensive, whether they always break down. So choose your partner with the same care you choose your car. And also, if you do need to recycle it so it's got a high resale, I shouldn't say that.
Resale value.
So learn from the experience. So if ever you make a mistake and life goes so-called wrong, it's just an opportunity to do better next time. Don't take it personally. Just learn to do better next time and choose more wisely. Do research. If it's a girl, check out with her old boyfriends what she's really like. So she, you know, she can't, because when you first go out with a girl, she's really sweet, she's really nice, does everything you like. Once you get married, then you find out who you've really teamed up with. Same with guys, they can impress you until you get married to them. Only then you find out they snore at night. Check it out first of all. Do research. Anyway, another question?
Okay, so that's some adult stuff. Now it's for kids. From Katen, I learned meditation from you, from YouTube.
Uh-oh.
But I want to know if there is a better way of meditation for kids. I am 10 years old.
10 years old, that's great. Sometimes we underestimate children. 10 years of age, if it's working for you, Peyton, carry on. And don't ever underestimate yourself. Just because you're 10 doesn't mean you're not smart. Keep on going. However, there is other things on YouTube for meditating with children. And one of the things which I developed when I was a young monk was asking children to visualize. Because many young children have got a very imaginative mind. So, in the early years, my first years in Perth, that was about 30 years ago now, I told my little kids group to imagine, close their eyes, relax the body. I said, imagine you are floating out of your body and floating over the rooftops of Perth, down to the ocean, because kids love the ocean in Australia, over the beach, into the ocean, into your private place, and the water, you feel yourself going into the water, and it's just so warm, and peaceful, and safe, and you look around, there's no ships, and there's no people, this is your own private place. You don't need to swim to stay afloat, you just lie there, and you float naturally, not a care in the world, warm, not cold, with a gentle, fragrant breeze just blowing over the ocean, keeping you just nice, and you can feel the warm, salty water just around your body, just keeping you afloat with not a care in the world. You may see some beautiful birds just flying over you in the ocean. Are you getting into it? I was. And then it's the time now to come back. Imagine yourself leaving your special place in the warm ocean, peaceful, floating up, back over the beach, over the rooftops, into the temple, back into your body. Now open your eyes. And I thought that was only kid stuff. But all those children I taught that to, they tell me they still practice that as their meditation. And they still do that because they started using visualization. Go to some peaceful spot for Australia in the ocean, warm, in a mountain or somewhere very nice and peaceful and safe. And then straight away the children feel so comfortable and peaceful there. A little old place for themselves which they can always go back to whenever they're worried or afraid or feel stressed. It worked. So you can try things like that. Just understanding that when you're very young you can imagine so much, and we lose the ability to imagine when we get a bit older. Not everybody, because some people have a strong imagination and a strong visual mind later on in their life as well. But for kids, my experience is that most kids have very, very powerful imaginary minds. So make use of that. So, Peyton, maybe you can try that.
Okay. Another question. How to build up my confidence? I face roadblocks in my career and feel the need to do a career change, but I kept questioning if I'm good enough. At the same time, my relationship, though good, but I have no idea where it will be leading it to, as he's still separated.
Okay. Could somebody hold up one of those green t-shirts? This is the first piece of advice for you. Buy one of the t-shirts which says, I am good enough. And when you wear that, it's reinforcing the message that you will brainwash yourself. You see that on yourself many times a day. But please, no, don't wear it all the time. Please wash it. Otherwise you'll stink and you realize you ain't good enough. But it just reinforces the message you are good enough. And you get this wonderful thing called confidence, which is the key to things. Angie, I'm going to make a confession to you today. Because when we were on that retreat in Hua Hin, you showed a clip from Kung Fu Panda. When I was flying, it's a confession, when I was flying from Bangkok to Singapore on Singapore Airlines, I looked through the magazine and it was showing Kung Fu Panda. So I actually watched it. Kung Fu Panda. So, you're not supposed to watch movies as a monk, but I thought it was research. And so that was only yesterday when I came in, last night. And I remember, I think, what was it? That Po, the Kung Fu Panda, the only reason why he wasn't good at Kung Fu because he had no confidence. And he got this scroll. And the scroll had nothing on it. There was no secret. Only in it he could see his own reflection. He realized he was good enough, as good as anybody else. And then because Kung Fu Panda, he got confidence. And that's all he needed to defeat the other bad guy. He was not really a bad guy. He'd just been treated badly as a kid. But anyway, sort of Kung Fu Panda became the hero. Even though he was fat, that's why I could relate to him. and became the master of the other kung fu experts. And isn't it the case that to become a real master, you have to be fat? So just because I'm fat doesn't mean I can't do kung fu. Be careful how you treat me. But that's how you get confidence. Just to look at yourself in the mirror, realizing you're as good as anybody else. And honestly, the confidence is always the key to success. Believe you can do it. And if it doesn't work out the first time, if you fail, we always call failing just part of the road to success. It's called forward failing. You learn and you get better the next time. It's part of the training to be Kung Fu Panda. You have to fail many times, but you keep on going. You never, what was the word? That's right, because you showed me the clip. You never quit. That's what they said, wasn't it? Don't quit. So, that's the way you can get success. If you never quit, you will always reach your goal. So, whether it's in a relationship, do you want to quit? Or keep on working with confidence, you can work it out. Obviously, if it goes too far, it's beyond the point of working it out. But sometimes the confidence is looking yourself in the mirror and realizing you're as good as anybody else. Everybody else has got two eyes, two ears, a nose and a mouth. So what's the difference between you and them? And you'll find the successful people in this world, they're just confident. They're not smart. Their brain is no bigger than your brain. Their education may be better, but that doesn't make them successful. Successful people are the confident ones. I can do this. I haven't got there yet, but it doesn't mean I won't. So that is for the monastic, the Australian version of Kung Fu Panda, Ajahn Brahm. Okay,
next question. Okay, so how can we train our mind, our lazy mind, to be interested or disciplined in meditation? And adding on, what will be a good practice to keep our internet suddenly gone? So.
Internet suddenly gone. That's a very good way to practice meditation. Turn off the internet and then you've got nothing else to do, so you might as well meditate.
What is a good daily practice to help us cultivate good daily meditation?
Okay, well, let's get another question which is similar. When is the best time to meditate and when is the worst time to meditate? And the best time to meditate is now. The worst time to meditate is later. If you understand that, you'll always find time to meditate. So, and once you find meditation is happy, I look at meditation as my default state. When my little tablet, I've got a Samsung tablet. When I'm not using it, the screen goes off. That's like my meditation. When I'm not giving a talk or answering questions about marriage and business and all sorts of stuff, my mind turns off. And that is called meditation. The default state. When there's nothing to do, you are still. No need to do anything. And that is what meditation is all about. It's not something more you do. Another task you have to complete. I have to wash the dishes. I have to look at my emails. I have to do my meditation. That's not what meditation is. It's just letting things go, relaxing, resting, sitting down, doing nothing. That's why my meditation is perfectly suited to lazy people. If you're lazy, come and learn meditation from me, and you'll really increase your penetration of laziness. You will take laziness to summits of indolence you've never experienced before. You are so lazy you don't even think. Totally peaceful. Now that is laziness. That's also meditation as well. Meditation is the most fun thing I've ever learned how to do. I never think, oh, I've got to meditate. I'm a monk. I better meditate. It's just when I don't do anything. Sit down, close my eyes, and stop and rest. I work hard. I need my rest. So I stop and rest. Aren't you tired? Meditation is learning how to rest really deeply. So once you get to understand what it's all about, it's not only easy to do, it's also fun to do. Because I meditate a lot, that's why I'm a fun monk. I'm fun in my meditation, fun when I'm out of meditation. Okay, another question.
Good question. My friend has had a relapse cancer, and the doctors don't seem to understand what she has or how to treat her, and they have informed her that there is no cure, although they are giving her chemotherapy to slow down the progress. She tries hard to stay positive, but now she feels like her end is near. How do I convince her to stay positive and believe that she will make it through?
Okay, sometimes be rebellious. Why believe those doctors? I'm going to show them. I'm not going to die. Sometimes be rebellious. Sometimes I'm rebellious like that. If people say it can't be done, I say, why not? And I make it happen. You all know, like with like the ordination of bhikkhunis, people said, you can't do it. And that was like a red rag. What do you mean I can't do it? So I did it. When they say that, what, you can't sort of work so hard. I said, yes, I can. I am going to do it. So I have a rebellious streak in me. When people say, you can't, I say, why not? So if the doctors say you're going to die, I say, I am not going to follow your advice. I'm going to follow my own advice. So if I want to die, I will die. But I'm not going to follow your commands, doctors. Just like when people say, have a happy new year, Ajahn Brahm. I say, why? I'm not going to follow you. You don't control me. Just to show you, I'm going to have a miserable new year. Just to show I'm independent. When people say, have a good day, I say, no, I will not. Just because I won't be controlled by other people. So sometimes rebellious. Don't always believe what other people tell you. Doctors are great. They really work hard trying to help people. But please remember, this was something which he was a friend, a Buddhist doctor, told me when he went to med school in Sydney. The head of department, who was just about to retire, a famous professor of medicine, he welcomed all the students to the new intake of med students by saying, 50% of what we're going to teach you in the next 4 years is wrong. My problem is, I do not know which 50% it is. Now, to me, that was a great scientist. He was humble enough to admit that we don't know everything. And in fact, the amount of things which doctors don't know is huge. So what the doctor should say, I don't know anything else we can do. It looks like, you know, you should die, but who knows? This is the truth of the matter. Because in my life I've seen too many people who should be dead and are still alive. Medicine can't understand what's gone on, but they're still here. So tell your friend what I've just said. A great professor of medicine, only about 10 years ago, said 50% of what we're going to teach you, medical students, is wrong. But we don't know which 50% it is. We're trying. We get some idea. But there's so much other stuff going on which we haven't really yet understood. Science, medicine, is always in progress. It's never completed yet. And the understanding of modern diseases like cancer, again, is still so much is not understood yet. Now, how it happens, why it happens, why it disappears, so much we don't know. So, leverage on what we don't know. And don't condemn yourself to misery because of the little we do know.
Okay, some combined questions, Ajahn Brahm. How to forgive someone who is not sorry? And how can we let go past mistakes? Some mistakes made regret without a chance to redeem it.
Okay, how to forgive someone who doesn't admit they're sorry? Forgiveness has got nothing to do with them. Forgiveness is always a gift you give to yourself. You forgive other people so you don't have to carry that burden of anger and resentment for the rest of your life. It's for you, not for the person who did the wrong thing. So forgiveness is a choice which sets you free. It doesn't set the other person free, it sets you free. So if someone's really hurt you, they've mistreated you, they cheated you, forgiving them means I am not going to allow them to hurt me again. Because every time I think of that, remember that, I'm allowing them to hurt me again. Taking away my happiness. Always thinking, why did they do that? That was really hurt me. Every time you remember that, they're hurting you again. So forgiveness is setting yourself free. Nothing to do with the other person. It's setting yourself free. Because as for you, things which you have done wrong, no one else can forgive you. Even if you've done something wrong, something really hurtful, and the people you've hurt said, oh, I forgive you, I let it go. That doesn't really make much of a difference to you. You still suffer because of your own bad karma. And if you go to a Buddha, or you go to a Jesus, you go to anyone to ask forgiveness, it doesn't work. The only person who can ever forgive you is yourself. And one day it happens. A Buddha, a monk, a Jesus, they can encourage you to forgive yourself, but you have to do it. And someday you look in the mirror, and the stuff which you've done was wrong and bad. You look at yourself and say, I've suffered enough. And just punishing myself by not forgiving myself does not help, does not move anything forward. So instead of punishing myself, I acknowledge I've done something wrong. I forgive myself and I learn from it. Mistakes in life, even big mistakes, are where we learn to do better next time. We don't punish ourselves, we grow from the mistakes we make, become better human beings. And that is exactly how the Buddha taught. He said, when you acknowledge your mistakes and you forgive and you learn, he said, that's the growth of a human being in Buddhism. Not punishing, acknowledging, forgiving, learning. The AFL code, acknowledge, forgive, learn. Okay?
Okay, next. This is some amazing question, Ajahn Brahm.
Be prepared.
No, I mean, some people took a pen and paper and then pass it through our PRO volunteers and even took a photograph and messaged it to me. So the effort took in this question is quite amazing. Ajahn, how do you advise if I am taking care of an elderly with very negative mental state every day?
Yeah, if you are caring with somebody who's got a very negative mental state every day, just remember it's the elderly person, it says sickness or old age which is speaking. It's not them. They're old, they're weak, they're sick. And it's that sickness which is being negative, not them. So when they're negative, you have to be the dustbin, the trash can. But as my master always said, let them dump all their negativity in you. But you have to be a trash can with a hole in the bottom. They dump it in you, but you keep nothing. It just goes right through you. They're negative, oh yes, yes, yes. Allow them to dump, but don't keep anything. And then every now and again, they say something positive, because no one is negative all the time. And when they say something positive, that is when you congratulate them, you celebrate them, you acknowledge them, say, oh, that's this amazing, wonderful, incredible, lovely thing you just said. I am so impressed with your compassion. I've never heard an old person like that saying such a beautiful thing. That is amazing. That is wonderful. Just go over the top with your praise and reinforcement. Because when you reinforce positive qualities in the elderly person, you encourage him to show more positivity. And it's amazing just how that little technique, just accepting but not reacting to negativity and acknowledging, celebrating, going over the top with reinforcing the positive qualities can change a person totally around. Just like one of the stories in my book, when I went to the United States, there was one man who was making a fortune with positive psychology, with pets in New York. Because in New York, a big city, people like having little dogs and cats. But the dogs in particular, now they could not poo or wee in the apartment. So they had to be trained to go outside and do their business in the appropriate places, in the parks or places outside the apartment. And how can busy people in New York train their little dogs to do their business in the right place? And so this man started a business to potty train little dogs. And it was such a simple technique. When the dog was a little puppy, the trainer would take it outside into the park and wait for it to do its business in the right place. And as soon as a dog did poo or pee in the right place, the trainer would punch the air. Yeah! Woohoo! Do a cartwheel! Do a little dance and sing a happy song! To give that dog positive reinforcement. And it worked! Even dogs, when they see their owners or their trainers, get so happy, so overjoyed that they pooed by the tree instead of the apartment, they soon got trained. So from that time on, they'd only do their business in the right place, never in the apartment. Even little dogs are subject to positive reinforcement, just like you train old people. Just like you train wives. When she cooks you something nasty, don't complain. When she cooks you something beautiful, punch in the air. Yes, that was such a beautiful bowl of noodles. I've never had such a bowl of noodles like that anywhere before. You are amazing. You're incredible. and then she'll do it again for you. But the problem was, that was when I was in New York. When I got to San Francisco, I got news that that person's business went bankrupt. There was a flaw, a fundamental flaw in his training method. The positive reinforcement, every time they did their business outside, the trainer would punch the air, sing a happy song, go, yeah. And the little dog was in the apartment with the owner when the owner was watching the football on the TV. And when the owner's side scored a goal, he would punch the air and say, yes, come on! And that's when the dog pooed. Be careful of positive reinforcement. Sometimes it works against you. Okay.
Okay. Today, a friend was sharing about mediums and spirit channelers.
Oh, good.
Are such people also use their mind power? What is the difference?
Yeah, mind power of people who are dead. This, I love telling this story. I was, should have told it this afternoon at another talk. True story, a Sri Lankan woman who is one of my disciples, living in Colombo, that her, I think, uncle had a bad cancer. So they sent him to the Singapore General Hospital here, SGH, to try and get the best possible care. But after a few months in hospital, this poor man was dying. He's already in a... No, sorry. He was paralyzed from the neck down with the cancer. I don't know what cancer it was. He was paralyzed and was only had about 3 or 4 days to live. So she called me in Australia and said, I know you're really, really busy, but my uncle is dying. Could you please talk to him? Just give him some last advice before he died. So of course I said, yeah, it doesn't matter how busy I am, I'll do that. So she put him on the telephone. He was so weak he could hardly speak. So I did most of the talking for him. And after about 10 minutes, that was enough. I was tiring him out. I rang the next day and the third day. They actually called me. 3 days I counseled him from Australia here in Singapore by phone. And the fourth day, they never called. I knew he must have died. So the next day, his niece called and said, yeah, he died last night, the night before. That's why we didn't call. I said, yeah, I expected that. But she said, you would not believe this, but it's absolutely true. I would not lie to you. You're my teacher, my master. I can't lie to you. Strange thing happened. About 8 hours after he died, she received an email from him. Please thank Ajahn Brahm. And it was sent 8 hours after he died. Now, you couldn't say he sent that beforehand because he was paralyzed from the neck down for days beforehand because of his cancer. And after he died, he sent email. I often said that being a monk who doesn't know very much about IT, I always wondered what Gmail stood for. Ghost mail. So just because a person's dead, please check your email. They may have said something to you. That's actually a true story. I'd actually love to find out other cases of ghosts sending emails after you're dead. Because obviously in the ghost world they've got very, very good Wi-Fi. What have they got? 4G. Ghosts. For ghosts. But there's power of the mind in that realm. There's so many stories of what happens when after people die. I've been telling a few people this story, that an Australian woman, she went, oh, did I tell it at the beginning about the, she went to UK? No, I think I told it this afternoon. An Australian girl, she went to England on holiday. And while she was in England, like many people would do, they went to visit a castle, an old English castle. You don't have castles in Singapore or Australia. So she went into this ancient castle, hundreds of years old. And in ancient times, some of the things which happened in those castles were very cruel and violent. Many people were tortured or had their heads chopped off or were killed in those castles. So as you would expect, they're really spooky. So as she was being led around this castle by the guide, she went through passages where suddenly it went cold. Sometimes when they trod on the ancient floorboards, creak. And often when they went past the window, the wind would whistle. It was really scary and dark. And when they finished the guide, when he finished the tour, she turned around and asked the guide, have you ever seen a ghost in this castle? And it's the sort of place you would find ghosts, really creepy. And the guide turned around to her and said, in all the years I've lived in this castle, I've never ever seen a ghost. That's what the guide said. So she asked the guide, how long you've been living here? And he said, 300 years. You never know who's a ghost and who's not a ghost. So be careful of the guides in old English castles.
Some more questions, Ajahn Brahm?
Yeah, I'm happy, but what time do we have to finish? It's about 9:30. Maybe one more question and then we can finish up.
Okay. I have practiced loving-kindness, metta, meditation, and realized difficult people in my life have become easier to work with.
Well,
I wonder if it is me, them, or us. How does metta work?
Oh, very much is us. Because when you actually practice loving-kindness to other people, even other animals, they can feel it. Animals are great feeling loving-kindness. Because it means that animals like that monk who pats snakes on the head, they will never bite you. Animals in monastery where I live, there's a big snake who lives there. As soon as they come and see the monks, never harms them. Because they know the monks are kind and soft and cuddly. So they can't be harmed. Loving kindness makes you invulnerable. So people feel that. Have you ever been in a room and a very angry, nasty person walks in? And you can feel it. Now one of the monks, he told me there was a monk called Dhamma Wudo. He was in somebody's house in Malaysia. And this man walked in and straight away he felt so uncomfortable. Even though he's a monk, he felt, I want to get out of this room. Who is that guy? And the other people told him he was the public executioner. The one who actually pulled the lever when people get hung. And he said he didn't know he was a public executioner before he came in, but he could feel, this is a very bad man. You can feel, and you don't have to be psychic to know that. You know, when a bad person comes in, you feel really terrible and afraid and you tighten up. When a really soft, kind person comes in, you feel really relaxed. You feel open and happy. Just like when I come into the room. it's Ajahn Brahm. I'm not going to be hurt. So it does work. So it is your loving kindness gets into that person, you feel much better. It opens the door of your heart. And as someone said earlier, this is my last chance, there is a big donation box outside. So open the door of your heart, and the door of your handbag, and the door of your wallet. Because all the donations tonight are going to be used for my nun's monastery, which needs to build a road because of the local council has insisted, because of bushfire regulations, we build a bigger road. So we're collecting some funds for that. So, open the door of your wallet. Very good.
Thank you very much, Ajahn Brahm. On behalf of the community, we would like to express our gratitude. And brothers and sisters, as per tradition, can we put our palm together and then say three sadhus very, very loudly? One, two, three.
Sadhu! Sadhu! Sadhu!
Okay, so with that, we would like to close today's talk, and we would like to express gratitude and thank you to all of the volunteers, all the brothers and sisters in yellow. To Bodhinyana Singapore and Brahm Center, who have sponsored the venue. And also, and ladies and gentlemen, if you see an apron or bags with Ajahn Brahm's quote, please don't forget to buy them. Again, the proceed will go to the Dhammasara Nuns Monastery, as what Ajahn Brahm has said. They are building a road, so need a lot of money. With that, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, thank you very much for your time today. Have a great evening. May you all be well and happy. Thank you. Thank you.